From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Robert Kaplan was warning about a crisis in the Balkans before the war, before most of us were paying attention to that part of the world. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Kaplan about the history and hatreds behind the fighting. It's the subject of his new book, Balkan Ghosts. Reports of mass murder, systematic rape, and ethnic cleansing led the UN Security Council last week to vote to establish an international tribunal to prosecute war crimes in the former Yugoslavia. We'll talk with Christopher Simpson, author of a new book about genocide and international law. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us what he doesn't like about the latest trend in performances of Baroque music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The standoff apparently continues around the heavily fortified compound of a religious sect near Waco, Texas. The leader of the sect, David Koresh, promised earlier today to surrender peacefully with all his followers if local radio stations broadcast his taped religious message. That message was aired more than 3 hours ago. When the broadcast began, federal agents brought prison buses and ambulances up to the compound, apparently to take away sect members. So far, there's been no sign that the surrender has begun. At least 6 people were killed Sunday when federal agents attempted to storm the compound and seize weapons. Reports from the compound say that more people may have been killed inside the buildings. Defense Secretary Les Aspin says the United States may temporarily halt its airdrops of humanitarian aid to besieged Bosnians. Aspin says the mission has been a success. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Aspin briefed members of the House and Senate on the airdrops this afternoon. He later told reporters today's airdrop, the third, may be the last for a while as the Clinton administration assesses the mission. Aspin says by allowing land convoys to resume, the airdrops have accomplished their goal.
To try and use leverage to get the ground flow of humanitarian aid going. And in that, it was a success.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell, said the 3 flights each dropped 10 bundles of aid. He says 15 of those bundles have been sighted in the drop zone, and the U.S. is reasonably sure the other 15 landed there as well. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Labor Secretary Robert Reich says although the economy is bouncing back, job growth is not. His comments were part of a sales pitch for the administration's economic stimulus package to the National Association of Private Industry Councils in Washington. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
The association represents the country's private and public sector leaders who help organize job training and education needs across the country. Secretary Reich says the administration wants to invest $10 billion over the next 4 years to expand the Job Corps and other programs for disadvantaged youth, as well as youth apprenticeship programs and more training for the millions of Americans who will lose their jobs due to changing technology and military cutbacks. Reich says this makes these initiatives especially important.
This recession just ending, based on our studies, based on the industries that are declining, based upon dislocated workers, 44% of the unemployed will not be getting their jobs back.
More money for training and education will be one of the issues the administration will have to fight for in its budget negotiations with Congress. This is Anthony Brooks in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 45 points to close at 3,400.5. This is NPR. As he prepared to leave Somalia, U.S. Envoy Robert Oakley said that the U.S.-led military coalition has made the country safe for deliveries of humanitarian aid. Mogadishu, Somalia's capital, was reported to be relatively calm today as representatives of 15 armed factions handed in lists of their weapons and troops. Violence continued in the southern port city of Kismayu, where 3 Somalis were killed and 16 wounded in a grenade blast. NBC announced today that the president of its troubled news division, Michael Gartner, is stepping down. Gartner's resignation follows criticism of the network for faking parts of a news report on the alleged dangers of GM pickup trucks. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
In an announcement read on the Today Show this morning, NBC said Gartner was giving up control of day-to-day news operations and will formally resign August 1st. Gartner said he hoped the announcement would take the spotlight off the network and allow it to concentrate fully on its business. Gartner has presided over the news division during a tumultuous period. He was widely criticized for allowing major budget cuts and for the unpopular decision to replace Jane Pauley with Deborah Norville on the Today Show. Then last month, the network was forced to make an on-air apology for a Dateline NBC report alleging that the fuel tanks of GM pickup trucks exploded during collisions. The network later admitted that an igniter had been placed under a truck in a test crash shown on the program. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The government's index of leading indicators was up a very modest 0.1% in January, but analysts are interpreting it as a sign of continued moderate economic growth. The analysts were heartened by the fact that the index had its biggest growth spurt in nearly a decade in December, rising by 1.7%. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the war in the Balkans, when most of us weren't paying attention to that part of the world, journalist Robert Kaplan was warning about the coming crisis. His new book, Balkan Ghosts, is a political travel book that helps explain the history and the hatreds behind today's fighting. The book is based on the 7 years he lived in Greece, during which he traveled through Yugoslavia, Albania, Romania, and Bulgaria. His previous book, Soldiers of God, was about his travels in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen, the Muslim guerrillas who resisted the Soviet invasion. Kaplan is a contributing editor for The Atlantic magazine and has written for The New Republic. Right now he lives in Washington, D.C. He says that throughout the 80s, he tried to interest editors and the general public in the Balkans' brewing crisis, but he had little success.
Because it's been about 4 or 5 generations' worth of policymakers and journalists since the last time the Balkans was front page. Remember, even in World War I and World War II, when there were massive battles being fought in the Balkans, there were even bigger battles on the Western Front, on the German-Russian frontier. So even in the two world wars, even though the Balkans started World War I, the Balkans was still more or less a sideshow. So the Balkans became, psychologically speaking, a sort of like metaphor for obscurantism. So it became like psychologically impossible for people to conceive of a situation where the Balkans would be number one in the world.
So what was it like for you to be reporting from a part of the world that many saw as too confusing and inconsequential?
It was eerie. I lived in Greece for 7 years, and I made my living going back and forth to Afghanistan, to the Horn of Africa, and all over the Middle East. My hobby and my obsession became the Balkans, and I would go back and forth to Zagreb, but back and forth to Bosnia, back and forth to Belgrade, and also to the other capitals. And I was frequently, if not always, the only journalist in town. I would have the whole place to myself. And what I quickly realized was that beneath the carapace of communism, there was just a place just riven, boiling with ethnic tensions. And once the lid of communism came off or started to unravel, which was apparent before 1989, actually, in 1988, it became, you know, it was an easy conceptual jump to realize that once communism was over, all this would break out again. The day the Berlin Wall fell, I was in Kosovo reporting on a riot between Serbs and Albanians. I was the only American journalist there, and only one of 5 or 6 journalists there. The others were all local Yugoslav reporters. And I remember my editor telling me, you know, Europe's coming together. You know, what are you reporting about this? And in fact, it inspired me to write a piece that was on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal Europe in November 1989, only 2 weeks after the wall fell, saying that Europe was not coming together. It was just redividing. Instead of East and West, NATO and Warsaw Pact, there would now be Central Europe and the Balkans. And while Central Europe was something the media knew all about, the Balkans was something the media would discover over the coming years.
So how has it felt for you to now be an expert on the part of the world that is the international obsession?
It's sort of a good, bad feeling. Good in the sense that I've learned to have more confidence in my own judgment. And to know that what is likely to happen in a few years is also likely to be something that the conventional pundits will laugh in your face at if you suggest it. It's also been a bad feeling because I've become very fatalistic, because you realize that even when you predict something, it doesn't help. If it's fated to play out, it does. I mean, this happened in Iran in the 70s when there was one after another first or second secretary at the embassy who was writing reports about fundamentalism, and nobody wanted to listen to them. This happens all the time. And in fact, I should say that I was not the only one. If you had gone to Belgrade in the mid-80s, one after another Reuters correspondent predicted this. In fact, I remember having a lunch with Reuters correspondent Peter Humphrey in Belgrade in 1988. He had just penned a series of articles explaining why Slobodan Milosevic was going to destabilize Europe in the coming years. At that point, nobody except Peter, I, and a few others even knew who he was.
You know, I think I'm one of the people who's kind of guilty of overlooking the Balkans and other parts of the world, too. And I know why, also. I usually have to be dragged kicking and screaming into understanding a new part of the world because it's so hard.
Yes, it is.
There's just too much. I just cannot digest all the things going on around the world.
Also, the Balkans is not visually friendly to television. Beirut was first-class hotels next to first-class satellite facilities with street fighting right down the street. The Balkans is a bit like Afghanistan. The logistics are harder. Everybody looks the same. The names are all unpronounceable with too many consonants and not enough vowels. It is a region that nobody wants to cover until they're forced to cover. Yugoslavia is so complex ethnically and historically that it resists condensation within the strictures of hard news writing. Meaning by the time a reporter would say that there are six republics and two autonomous provinces and three languages and two alphabets, well, 400 of his 800 words are finished already, and the reader is bored to death.
Well, you say that the drama is in the process in which hatreds build in Yugoslavia. That's a difficult thing to write about, too, isn't it?
It's something that can only be written about by showing it, not by explaining it. You see, the minute you hear about all these ethnic hatreds, the first instinct of a journalist is to condense, to strip away, to capsulize, to pick one or two things and to summarize. But the whole thing about the Balkans is that people have these incredible memories that go back hundreds of years where they remember every single detail. And once you start stripping away the details, you start diluting the memories. And then you find it harder to understand why these people are acting so irrationally.
I think it's hard for Americans, in part because America is a relatively new country, to understand the depth of history in this crisis, the depth of the historical sense of people feeling they were wronged.
America's made an end run around history.
Yeah.
These people have run into history like a brick wall. And they've done that because, well, first it's geographical. Look at it this way. The Balkans is a mountainous region where mountains have separated one people from the other, and therefore the people were always ruled by an outsider. Whether it was Byzantium, Ottoman Turkey, or Tsarist or Communist Russia, there was always an outsider keeping these squabbling peoples more or less at peace. Now we face, for the first time ever, an historically unprecedented situation. There is no outsider willing to insert the necessary amount of force to keep these people at peace. And what each of these peoples long for is to reconstitute their empires at the time of the greatest imperial expansion, meaning that everybody's territorial dreams conflicts with everybody else's.
As you traveled around and you'd meet strangers on the road, you'd try to talk with them about their hatreds, just to kind of get a sense of where that was coming from. Is there a chance you could tell us a couple of stories that would be illuminating for us?
Yes. I'll tell you two. One about a city and another about a man. The city is Zagreb, the capital of Croatia. And when I went there in 1981, in 1985, 1989, the obsession was the same. Everyone wanted to talk about one man whose name I've never seen mentioned in any of the journalists' accounts. His name was Alojza Stepinac, the cardinal and archbishop of Croatia during World War II. The Serbs considered him a war criminal who baptized with one hand and slaughtered with the other. The Serbs, the Croats rather, considered him a national saint, who had in fact saved many Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies. The fact is nobody has yet come to terms with this man's legacy. I found there was no city in Europe where the Holocaust was still so undigested and still so fought over as in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia. This is what everybody wanted to talk about, one man in the 1930s. Another time was I was walking on the road in Romania and I met this old Jewish man, and all he wanted to talk about was what in Romania is known as the Slaughterhouse Massacre, where in two nights in 1941, in January, 200 Jewish men, women, and children were dragged out of their homes, taken to a municipal slaughterhouse, stripped naked, and put through all the stages of animal slaughter. He took me to the graves of these 200 people. And this event is still fought over between Romanian fascists, Jews, Romanian liberals, all who blame somebody else for it.
Journalist Robert Kaplan is my guest. He lived in Greece for about 7 years. He's traveled for many years throughout the Balkans and has written a new book called Balkan Ghosts. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Robert Kaplan is my guest, contributing editor of The Atlantic and author of the new book, Balkan Ghosts. You attribute some of the ethnic conflict in the former Yugoslavia to the differences between the Western Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodoxy. Why is that such a big deal?
All right. Croatia and Serbia are... Croatia is the most southeasternmost of Western Catholic nations. Serbia is the northwesternmost of Eastern Orthodox nations. In a sense, the difference between Catholics and Orthodox is even greater than the difference between Jews and Christians, because Judaism, because of the diaspora, has become a Western religion, as is Protestantism. Jews may consider themselves Jews, but their operating culture in the West is that of Protestant Calvinism. In the Eastern Church, deeds count less than just often going through the motions of ritual. In the East, ritual and magic count for a lot. In the West, deeds and doing good works do. A Western wedding ceremony can take only an hour or so. In the East, it could last for 4 days. They are metaphors for completely different approaches to life. Do not assume that because both the Croats are Christian and the Serbs are Christian that they therefore should be brothers. This is not the case. In terms of mentality, there may be more similarities between Eastern Orthodoxy and Islam than there is between Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity, because both Eastern Orthodoxy and Islam are both Eastern religions, rather.
Has Christianity and Islam been at odds with each other in the Balkans historically, or is this relatively new?
Yes, they have been at odds historically, because the Bosnian Muslims, and even more particularly the Albanian and Macedonian Muslims, are the living appendages of four or five centuries of Ottoman Turkish rule, because these people are Muslim only because the Turks converted them. So for the Serbs, the Bosnians represent the living reminder of being slaves to the Turks for 4 or 5 centuries, because if had the Turks hadn't been there, there wouldn't be Muslims in the area in the first place.
The Muslims have been victims in the war in the Balkans, but a while ago you wrote that when the cult of atheism ends
in Yugoslavia that Muslim violence against Orthodox Christians is a possibility. Do you think it could have gone either way?
Yes. What needs to be remembered is that Yugoslavia is a civil war. The Serbs are doing most of the oppressing because they have the numbers and they have the weapons. Had another one of these groups had the numbers and had the weapons, it's likely that they would now be seen as the bad guys in the eyes of the Western media. Though it is atmospherically similar to the Nazi Holocaust, it is different because these are atrocities that are happening within the maelstrom of civil war. It is not a premeditated policy of industrialized mass murder against an innocent people who have no weapons and no means to defend themselves. It's a little bit different.
Do you think that religious hostilities worsened under communism while they were suppressed?
Yes, precisely because they were suppressed. There was no outlet for them. The main crime of communism was that it kept people in an artificial and forced state of poverty for 4.5 decades while the rest of Europe was becoming middle class. By denying people middle class culture, they denied them the security that goes with being middle class. I mean, people who own cars, washers, dryers, who are paying off mortgages, aren't likely to pick up assault rifles and start guerrilla warfare. If you doubt me, look at the difficulties between the Flemish-speaking Belgians and the French-speaking Belgians, or the French-speaking Canadians and the English Canadians. They have great difficulties between each other, but they are being fought out in boring parliamentary battles because middle-class people don't go to war. The true tragedy of the Balkans is that the communists denied people from becoming middle class.
So you think that if the people in the Balkans were more middle class, that they'd be arguing it out in parliament?
If they were middle class, not more middle class.
Right,
and
yeah,
middle
right.
class not just for 10 years, but for several generations. Mm-hmm. In Greece, you have the interesting situation where you have a culture that has been middle class for only one generation, and yet Greek nationalism now is stronger than it's ever been. One generation of middle class culture is not enough. You need several generations in order to sedate and tranquilize ethnic hatred so that they become manageable.
For years, you tried to get people interested in the coming crisis in the Balkans. Now that everybody's interested in the crisis in the Balkans, do you see a next place where ethnic conflict is about to break out?
Yes, it's interesting. I'm not a journalist. I'm a magazine writer more, and the trick in magazine writing is to write about stories before they become stories. What I'm starting next is a big project. I'm going to be going to Africa, to India, to Indonesia, and I'm going to be writing about environmental and demographic stress that is going to cause warfare in the 21st century. Where population, soil depletion, things like that are going to get so out of control, they're going to hit critical mass. And they threaten the borders of most African and Asian countries, borders which may not exist in 20 years.
What about in the Balkans? Where do you see the conflict heading? You were telling me before the interview that you think it's all over for Bosnia.
Yes, I do. Bosnia cannot be reconstituted unless the international community is willing to send several hundred thousand troops to do that. I'm not sure that there's a willingness among the taxpayers of America or other West European states to do that. I think the most that could be done now is to keep the conflict from spreading, because Yugoslavia, Bosnia, whatever, is not going to be like Lebanon or like Northern Ireland, where it just continues, people continue to fight, but it drifts on to page 2 and page 3 because the novelty value of the war has worn off. This war, if it continues, it has to spread. It has to spread southward into Kosovo, Macedonia, threatening to draw Greece and Turkey into the conflict. It could spread northward and threaten to drag Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania in, and this is because of interlocking, chain-reacting ethnic hatreds. So what we have to do is to cauterize the conflict, to make sure that even if the fighting goes on in Bosnia, it does not spread. I've been one of those recommending sending a large peacekeeping force to Macedonia and Kosovo to keep it from spreading. Because what I fear is that because we lack the will to do anything bold and dramatic, we will be drawn into a kind of incrementalism, like in Vietnam, where we're doing airdrops now, 10,000 troops in 2 months, another 10,000 in 4 months, and they'll be diluted amidst the Bosnian countryside, where they'll be too many troops to be ignored, but too few to really do anything when the next round of ethnic cleansing gets started.
What do you think of the Vance and Owen peace plan?
The Vance-Owen peace plan is an awful peace plan, but there's nothing else out there in the moment. The only reason people are even taking it seriously is because nobody else is willing to get involved. This is an interesting situation in the Balkans, because everyone knows what needs to be done, but nobody wants to do it. So the result is we have a peace plan that's totally removed from any strategic or military logic that everybody is taking seriously, because nobody really wants to do anything, and the peace plan is a way of getting the United States and other countries off the hook.
When you say everybody knows what needs to be done, are you referring to the peacekeeping force?
No, I'm referring to what you have in the Balkans is a huge security hole that's tearing wider and wider and threatening to engulf other countries. The only way you plug a security hole is to send in force or to do something to redress the imbalance of force. The reason there's a security hole is because one side has too many weapons and is too willing to use it than the other side. The one way you cannot stop a situation like this is through negotiations. Negotiations have no role to play until the security imbalance is redressed.
What do you mean by a security hole?
A security hole is where nobody is in charge except for the side that has the most weapons and is willing to use those weapons. The Serbs know exactly what they want, and they're going for it. Everyone in Western Europe and America is talking, but the leaders in Serbia are willing to use force. Until somebody else is willing to credibly threaten force in the numbers required to slow down the Serbs, there will be a security vacuum.
What do you think of the food drop that the Clinton administration organized?
Somebody wrote in the papers, a pilot, that when you drop from 10,000 feet, the only thing you're sure of hitting is the earth. This is a political gesture, because nobody wants to take risks. Much of the food will drop into the, will land in the wrong hands. If you want it to land in the right hands, then you have to risk your own soldiers' lives. The fact that we're dropping food but at such a high altitude shows that we're still treating the Balkans with benign neglect. We want to claim that we're doing something when in fact we're doing very little.
You think that the Pope should be doing something in Yugoslavia?
Yeah, I think the Vatican's policy in Yugoslavia is indefensible, has been indefensible. There is no place in the world where the Vatican has so many skeletons in its closet as it has in Croatia. And the real reason that the Pope has never traveled to Croatia, which is a Catholic country where Catholicism is every bit as deeply embedded as in Poland, and is right next door to Italy, and less than an hour flying distance from Rome. Yet this pope has never gone, yet he's gone to places in Africa, in the Far East, in the Pacific. He has not gone because the Vatican is ashamed of what it has done in Croatia throughout much of the 20th century. Its role, along with that of the Habsburg monarchs, in inspiring the Croats' hatred of the Greek Orthodox Serbs.
Robert Kaplan, where are you off to next?
I'm going to Turkey in April and to Azerbaijan for 2 months to do a story for National Geographic.
About?
About Turkey as an emerging power in the 21st century.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Kaplan is the author of the book Balkan Ghosts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, the UN Security Council voted to create a war crimes tribunal to punish those who have committed atrocities in the former Yugoslavia. Coming up, we talk with Christopher Simpson about the difficulty of prosecuting war criminals. Simpson is the author of a new book about genocide, international law, and money. And he says countries often have financial and political reasons for looking the other way. Also, Baroque music played on original instruments has been creating some excitement in classical music circles, but classical music critic Lord Schwartz wonders what all the excitement's about. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin says that U.S. airdrops over Bosnia have allowed more land aid to get through, so these shipments by air may be suspended for a time. U.S. planes conducted a third airdrop into eastern Bosnia today, and Aspin told reporters after meeting with members of Congress this may be the last one for a while. Recently, the U.N.-sponsored land convoys have been blocked by Serbian factions. Earlier today, the U.S. praised Russia's offer to take part in the U.S. airlift. Texas billionaire Ross Perot was on Capitol Hill today, and he appeared before a joint House-Senate committee on congressional reform. He called on lawmakers to change the way that they conduct business in order to regain the public's confidence. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Perot appeared at the invitation of the Senate chairman of the joint committee, David Boren, an Oklahoma Democrat. His remarks were a conglomeration of his old campaign lines delivered in the form of a lecture to the lawmakers. He urged Congress members to relinquish their perks, reduce the influence of foreign lobbyists, and balance the federal budget.
The ordinary folks out there putting roofs on houses, fixing cars, doing the plumbing, the electrical work, the police officers around this country, understandably feel that after going $4 trillion into debt, our elected leaders should have created utopia for our citizens.
Several lawmakers took issue with Perot, such as Senator Harry Reid, a Nevada Democrat, who said, "Check your facts and stop listening to applause so much." I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The mayor of New York City has announced a $100,000 reward, and the New York Port Authority will match that amount for information leading to the arrest and conviction of those responsible for last Friday's bombing at the World Trade Center. Mandalit Del Barco of member station WNYC reports.
In announcing the reward, Mayor David Dinkins repeated his claim that New Yorkers are as safe as anywhere else in the world. He said the city will not allow terrorists to intimidate those who live and work here.
We cannot and will not submit to those forces who wish to panic our city, who disregard the value of human life, and more importantly, who think they can perpetrate such deadly, dastardly deeds without fear of retribution.
Dinkins also announced a program to counsel survivors, relatives, witnesses, and anyone else now dealing with the Twin Towers trauma. The Red Cross and the city's mental health department have set up a toll-free telephone hotline for counseling referrals. And starting Thursday, support groups will be formed in a series of community debriefings to provide what's known as psychological first aid. For National Public Radio, I'm Mandalit Del Barco in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 45 points to close at 3,453 on volume of more than 270 million shares. Trading again today was heavy. This is NPR News. Near Waco, Texas, a standoff outside a religious cult compound continues in an impasse that has gone on for more than 2.5 days now. Sunday, a raid by agents for the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in the compound ended in gun battles that killed 6 people, including 4 federal agents. Earlier today, an hour-long statement by the cult leader was aired on Texas radio stations at the request of the FBI. The cult leader said that he would give up peacefully if the statement was broadcast. Secretary of Education Richard Riley was on Capitol Hill today, hoping to pave the way for passage of a surprisingly lean education budget. Riley included a request for immediate help for needy school children and college students. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Secretary Riley told members of the House Budget Committee today that he needs $500 million right away to provide remedial reading and math to as many as 750,000 schoolchildren this summer. Another $230 million is needed to help poor kids in communities where school programs have been scaled down. And finally, Riley said, $2 billion is needed to reassure college students that their college grants are not going to be cut next fall. That's how much money the Pell Grant program is short. The Clinton administration's long-term education plan is to create a National Academic Standards Council committed to national testing and helping the nation's 16,000 school districts meet the national education goals. And a new federal program, Riley said, will target school violence. The budget for these and other proposals won't be ready until April 5th, when the president is scheduled to submit his first budget to Congress. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
Officials of the United Mine Workers have called an end to a one-month strike and agreed to a contract extension. A 1988 agreement is now extended until May 3rd. More than 9,000 miners have been affected by the walkout in 5 states. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last week, the UN Security Council voted unanimously to establish an international tribunal to prosecute war crimes in the former Yugoslavia. The vote followed a UN report which cited evidence of mass killings, systematic rape, the destruction of towns, and the violent removal of whole groups of people. UN officials and human rights observers agree that the overwhelming majority of war crimes have been perpetrated by Serbs. My guest Christopher Simpson has written a new book about genocide and international law called The Splendid Blonde Beast. A lot of his research for this book and other projects focused on Nazi war crimes. Simpson teaches at American University in Washington, D.C. The Balkan War Crimes Tribunal will be the UN's first attempt to try war criminals. I asked Simpson what problems the tribunal is likely to face.
On one level, the problems are similar to any court, right? You have to gather evidence. You have to establish who has jurisdiction, which court has jurisdiction over these particular types of crimes. The court has to enjoy the respect and credibility that gives it the authority to make a judgment. Then there's, similar to other courts, there's the usual administrative type problems. Does the court have enough money to do its job? Does the court have enough personnel support and so on? And one thing that we saw during World War II, by the way, is that they set up war crimes prosecution teams largely as a propaganda gesture during the war. It was mainly for publicity purposes, but they kept them on a short leash by giving them no money or authority. I don't know whether that will happen in this case, but certainly it's something to watch out for. But behind all of that, there's a more fundamental problem. And what that is that the structure of international law has been set up in such a way that it, in many circumstances, it tends to protect people who commit very serious crimes.
How does the law protect them?
Well, it's like this. To understand how, you have to go back to the turn of the century and sort of follow this thing forward. And basically what happened at the turn of the century is that there was a large, very expensive arms race among the major powers in Europe. And they came up with some proposals that were laws of war, that were an effort to, on the one hand, make war a little bit less barbaric, and on the other hand, to control the arms race of the day. And the basic property of this law of war is that war would be conducted among regular uniformed armies fighting on behalf of a organized government and with the government's authority. And this is some good reasons for doing this. At the same time, this had the characteristic of making rebellions, guerrilla warfares, those types of popular resistance to oppressive governments, making them illegal. So the way this played out in both World War I and World War II is that you had the dominant powers, the more powerful countries, would occupy a particular country. You would have a local rebellion against this occupation, and the dominant country would say, aha, they're committing war crimes. Therefore, if we commit war crimes against them to stop them from committing them, therefore what we do is legal, okay? It's called a reprisal. It's a legal doctrine known as reprisal. Now, to bring it up to the modern situation, what that means is that while politicians around the world can point to specific atrocities that are going on in the former Yugoslavia, some of which are clearly crimes in any common sense sort of way, actually prosecuting those crimes before an international tribunal may be considerably more complicated.
You know, I think a lot of us have been, you know, watching what's happening in the former Yugoslavia from afar and wondering, what is the responsibility of our government to try to intervene or to try to bring war criminals to justice? I'd really like to know what you think about that.
The thrust of it is, or the thrust of the way I look at it, is that the major powers of the world have set up an international system of law that largely benefits them. And they obey that law when it's advantageous for them to do so, and certainly make much noise about it in the media. For example, the prosecution of Manuel Noriega from Panama, the incursion into Grenada, and so forth and so on. But when the law is less to their liking, they ignore it. So what happens here is that international law is set up in such a way that those who have sufficient guns and money can obey it when they want to and ignore it when they want to. That type of approach to securing justice is never going to work over the long haul.
So if Noriega is an example of our country trying to obey international law, what's an example of our country ignoring it?
Well, for example, the mining of Nicaraguan harbors. This was clearly, as far as international law is concerned, it was an act of war. It was against the U.S. Constitution to do this. In any case, the Nicaraguan government, then led by the Sandinistas, took the United States to the International Court of Arbitration at The Hague, which was the appropriate forum, and the court held many hearings and so forth. The United States' response to this was not even to defend itself in these hearings, but simply what's called non-appearance. It refused to even play the game. The court eventually found in favor of the Nicaraguan government, condemned the United States for this particular action, and the Americans, the administration, continued a clandestine war against Nicaragua.
My guest is Christopher Simpson, author of the new book, The Splendid Blonde Beast, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Simpson. Your book, The Splendid Beast, is subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. What's the connection between money and genocide?
When radical, ideologically charged parties like the Nazis come to power, they've got an ideological agenda that they're pushing that includes genocide. But most people aren't going to buy that agenda, even if they vote for Adolf Hitler. So what do the Nazis or their equivalents do? Well, they introduce incentives into the society to participate in genocide. And so the first and most basic one was a program called Aryanization. And the Nazis were intent on driving people of Jewish heritage out of the German economy. So they essentially legalized Germans stealing from Jews. They could steal businesses. They could steal professional practices like law offices or doctor's offices. They would come in and take over the patients and so on. They could squeeze people with Jewish heritage out of the universities and so on. So you had many Germans saw this as an opportunity to advance themselves at the expense of other people, and they did.
So that's how genocide kind of becomes part of the structure of society. Not everybody is out there killing Jews in the case of Nazi Germany, but people that are given away to financially benefit from the destruction of the Jews and therefore are more likely to turn their heads when they find out what's happening.
Absolutely. And then afterwards, after the war, you have the circumstance where even people who maybe were not so enthusiastic about Hitler as such, they look back over their shoulder and they say, oh, my God, I'm living in a house that I got for pennies on a dollar back in 1935 from the Jew that disappeared, okay? And so that person maybe was not a big Nazi big shot, but that person is going to have a strong incentive to say, let's put this stuff behind us. We don't want to, call up all these old problems. Let's just move on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is a big part of the explanation for Germany's response, or some sectors of Germany's response today to the country's own history.
Now, you also say that there were certain incentives for American political and corporate leaders to help some of the former leaders of Nazi Germany escape without punishment.
Absolutely.
After the war, what were the incentives that Americans had to let them get away with it?
Several different ones. One was simple commerce, is that Germany is a large, very lucrative market. It's one of the most wealthy markets in the world. And some American corporate leaders saw that they could hold on to a big slice of the German market and the companies that are active there by protecting particularly corporate leaders who had cooperated with the Nazis. So part of it was greed. Part of it was a political question, that they were afraid that that the system of private enterprise as we know it in the United States was under siege in Europe, and that unless they put these people back into power, that the system would fall apart.
But your point is that there are sometimes disincentives against punishing war criminals.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that this is that what happened in Europe in the wake of the war is an example of that. People can, because the war criminals come from the existing power centers in society.
The industrial elite, the political elite.
Right, exactly. The religious leaders and so on. The university professors, the intellectuals, the so-called notables, the magazine publishers, the radio broadcasters, for example. These people still have some measure of power and authority and respect in the wake of a genocide. And there will always be factions, I don't know if there will always be, but there certainly are factions among the victors who see some sort of advantage in allying with them.
What you're saying now about Nazi Germany and how genocide was built into the system and how there were disincentives to prosecuting some of the Nazi leaders, could you apply that at all to the former Yugoslavia?
Oh, I think so. History doesn't repeat itself in some kind of neat little geometric pattern, but I think the European government's resistance to doing anything about the or doing much about the crisis in Yugoslavia is an illustration of this. They find themselves torn by their connections to the various factions in this conflict, so that they are they find themselves precluded from intervening to stop the fighting. Now, my personal opinion is, and this is not a particularly popular opinion, is that several European powers have a measure of responsibility for the civil war there, that this is not just something, an ethnic fight among Serbs and Croats. The German government backed the separation of Croatia from Yugoslavia, and it's clear that a large amount of the weapons in that conflict are coming from the former eastern satellite countries of the Soviet Union. You ask yourself, well, where do these people get all these guns, for heaven's sakes? Well, they're coming from the armies of the former East Bloc countries. You can imagine what the response would be if a country came to the United States or came to people in the United States and said to, like, for example, the Mexicans or the large Chicano population in the American Southwest, and said, okay, you all can have your own separate country now, and we'll recognize you diplomatically, and we'll give you guns to help pursue your aims. Well, what do you think the results would be? I think there would be an ethnic civil war in the southwestern United States, and I think that you would see some of these same sorts of atrocities take place. Frankly, I think that that's part of what's going on in Yugoslavia now.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Christopher Simpson is the author of The Splendid Blonde Beast, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're going to lead off with an interview with John Burnett, who is in Waco, about what happened there, and follow that with some background on the cult and the cult leader in Waco. We're also looking into the area where the U.S. dropped supplies into Bosnia. Apparently, part of that area has been overrun by Serb rebels. And we will also have another report from Rio Grande City in Texas. This one is about school kids. Some of them are the children of migrant workers. They come and they go, they told us. We'll talk to those kids.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For most of this century, Baroque music was either neglected or performed in an inappropriate style. But recent scholarship about style, performance practice, and original instruments has generated a tremendous new interest and excitement about early music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, however, sees some limitations to the historical approach to early music. In this wave of popularity, Lloyd says, some important aspects of the music seem to have gotten lost.
Early music is probably more popular today than it's been at any time since the days when it was actually new music. But I have a problem with a lot of current, historically informed performances. Every piece tends to get played the same way. In the effort to rebuke the 19th century for making Baroque music sound too heavy and slow, everything is now played faster and lighter. But everything also seems to sound thinner and smaller. It's as if musicians are only interested in the surface of the music. I had a wonderful 18th century literature teacher who once quoted some ridiculous lines from Handel's Acis and Galatea. "Wretched lovers, quit your dream. Behold the monster, Polypheme." Then she sent us to the music library to listen to it. It turned out to be one of the most glorious and moving choruses in all of Handel. Half the group is lamenting the inevitability of fate, while the other half is crying out to warn the two lovers of the monster's approach. This excerpt is from a 1960 recording conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt.
Behold, behold, behold the monster, Polypheme. Behold the monster, Polypheme. Behold the monster, Polypheme.
In the 18th century, the absurd and the sublime coexisted. But today's early music specialists seem to be afraid of the sublime. Here's that same chorus on a New London recording, with Christopher Hogwood conducting the Handel and Haydn Society Orchestra and Chorus. This version is in German and orchestrated by Mozart, but it's the rushed and perfunctory quality, not the German, that makes it almost unrecognizable. What rescues this Hogwood album from triviality is the superb orchestra and chorus and the vivid performance by Michael George as the comic yet menacing monster Polypheme. Here he is wooing the reluctant Galatea in O Ruddier Than the Cherry.
Du retter als die Kirche, du süße als die Beere. Du retter als die Kirche, du süße als die Beere. Du retter als die Kirche. Süße hat's die Beere, du reizende hat's Munden, schreib gleich Böcklein frisch. Frisch. Du reizende hat's Munden, schreib gleich Böcklein frisch.
There's another new Handel disc on Telarc, elegantly played by another world-class early music group, the Boston Baroque, conducted by Martin Perlman. They play the first half dozen of Handel's marvelous Concerti Grossi, Opus 6. Here's the beautiful Largo Affettuoso that opens the fourth. Now listen to the same music recorded in 1966 by Otto Klemperer and the Philharmonia Orchestra. It's just been reissued by Angel EMI. There are such good and thoughtful musicians performing Baroque music today. I don't want them to play it the same way it was played 25 years ago. But I wonder why most of them seem so reluctant to find some equivalent for the spaciousness and depth of feeling that an older musician like Klemperer saw in it, and that a composer like Handel must surely have intended.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret history of the German bomb. We talk with Tom Powers. His new book, Heisenberg's War, says that American spies and military leaders tried to assassinate or kidnap the German physicist Werner Heisenberg because they feared he could create an atomic bomb for Hitler. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.